Stand by. Welcome to today's program, titled Top 10 Steps Employers Can Take Today to Prevent and Properly Handle Sexual Harassment Claims. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, very bottom pod labeled chat. Then type and send your question that way. At the end of today's event, a link to an online evaluation will be displayed on your screen. Please take a few moments to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. I would now like to introduce our hosts for today's call, Judy Keyes, Chris Martin, Caitlin Fallon, and Mary Sannon. Judy, you may begin.
Well, thank you. Good morning, everyone. And I want to acknowledge that we have people from all over the country attending the program today. Thank you, all of you. And I want to thank my colleagues who joined me in presenting the program. Chris is in Portland, Oregon, and Caitlin in New York City, and Mary in Seattle. So we are very pleased to be able to present this and talk with you today for the next hour. We would ask that you please do submit any questions that you may have into that chat box. Our intention is to leave 5 to 10 minutes at the end of the presentation to answer your questions. I will be doing my best to compile them as we go along so that we can make the best use of our time today. So introducing our topic, it's no surprise to anyone on this call, I'm sure, to be reminded that sex discrimination, which is the reason for sex harassment laws, sex discrimination became illegal in the workplace in 1964. This is a very long time ago. So we have to stop and observe the fact that it's been more than 30 years since the law has been set, both federally and in many states across the country, and yet today sexual harassment is in the headlines all over the place, from the Wall Street Journal to the USA Today to the Person of the Year in Time magazine. Just today I received a special edition of Variety magazine devoted entirely to this issue. So we can see in the headlines that some people are accused and deny the accusations. Some are accused and acknowledge them. Perpetrators, some of them are resigning right and left. Some are being forced to leave. Some stay. We also have victims or the accusers of harassment who are credited with coming forward and given great acclaim for that. Some of them are discredited in the media. Employers are in the crosshairs. Why hasn't Human Resources done more? Why have employers tolerated this? Why has this been allowed to go for as long as it has? And many of us are asking, how can this be? Do we just throw up our hands and say it's just impossible? Or is there something that we can do? Certainly the blame or the responsibility can be allocated to many. It can't be overstated that the perpetrators of harassment certainly are responsible for their conduct, certainly are responsible for what it is that we are putting up with today. Often the perpetrators are powerful people, and that has to be acknowledged as part of the problem. In addition, we have to look for responsibility to those who enable it, whether it's the coworker who is aware of it and agrees to keep silent or decides to keep silent, maybe it's the manager, maybe it is Human Resources, who is aware of the problem, and either because they are not able to do it in the construct of the organization or because they choose not to do it. They see that their job perhaps is to protect the company for whatever reason, and often these are well-meaning people who want to protect the privacy, the confidentiality of somebody, who decide that they're not going to do more or do anything than they do. And then the victims. Some of the responsibility, it must be said and is being said, is attributable to people not coming forward when companies offer them hotlines and policies and all, you know, the government agencies are there that they can go to, and they choose not to do it, often because they're afraid, often because it's just too scary to come forward. But that part of the responsibility certainly must be laid at the feet of those who remain silent, both enablers and victims. And then, of course, there is the system that does not protect people who come forward, the system that perhaps is not well designed to ferret out what is serious harassment from that which may not be. So this is the situation we find ourselves in as we look in just a couple of weeks at 2018. And we have to ask ourselves, what is to be done? That's why we're here today. So I will now turn the program over to Caitlin in our New York office, who will talk about the first of the 10 steps that we recommend be considered seriously at this crucial time. Caitlin, take it away.
Thanks very much, Judy. So our first step to prevent and properly handle sexual harassment claims is to make a respectful workplace part of your company culture. This is crucial, as sexual harassment is not only illegal, but it negatively impacts everyone at the company. To combat this, it is essential to have a clear anti-harassment policy that includes a ban on sexual harassment. Of course, your anti-harassment policy should include other prohibited conduct, but for today's purposes, we will focus on sexual harassment. The anti-harassment policy should prohibit all forms of sexually harassing behavior, which includes any inappropriate, unprofessional, or disrespectful conduct that is directed at someone or done in the presence of someone, which includes the use of sexual innuendos at work. Additionally, the policy should also be written in such a way that employees actually understand it. The policy should also detail the company's complaint procedure and the company's policy to investigate claims, as well as a clear prohibition on retaliation. As the past few months have made clear, no one is above the policy. No one is so powerful or so important that they can be afforded the ability to behave inappropriately or be given a pass on the employer's policy. What is absolutely imperative to succeed in having a harassment-free workplace is to have leaders who demonstrate the same. Therefore, owners, CEOs and executives, boards of directors and managers, as well as top performers who may not have a formal leadership role, all must demonstrate their commitment to this effort. Leading from the top down and the sides will shape a company culture and demonstrate the commitment that is necessary to your employees that sexual harassment will not be tolerated and is not what the company stands for. Leaders who walk the walk will undoubtedly help shift a company culture to one where everyone can feel respected in the workplace. Without this effort from those in leadership positions, it will be difficult to accomplish any change. In order to demonstrate that your company demands a respectful workplace for everyone, it may require your company to press the reset button. That is, you may need to revise your policies, reiterate your expectations, redistribute your policies to your employees, and reinforce the significance of the policy. Refer to the policy regularly and train your employees on the same. This may even merit a strong statement from the CEO about the importance of the policy and the company's commitment to creating a respectful workplace, because ultimately, that is the goal. Our second tip is to make it easy to report harassment. A complaint does not need to be in writing and should not be required. You should not require employees to go through any sort of formal complaint process, and indeed, it is good practice to have multiple reporting avenues, such that an employee has an alternate means of raising his or her concerns if the person to whom she is supposed to report harassment to is, in fact, the alleged harasser. It is often misunderstood that someone needs to say the words, "I'd like to report X or Y," or alternatively, to swear to the truth of his or her claim, but that is not the standard. The fact of the matter is, a company should not do anything that will cause a chilling effect to an employee's reporting of his or her concerns. By having a clear policy that sets forth what an employee must do to relay his or her concerns, the company will lower the risk of having an employee say, "He told me not to do anything," or "She made me promise not to tell anyone." This only further highlights the need for a clear and well-understood anti-harassment policy that is well-disseminated to all of the company's employees. It is also imperative that supervisors are trained. In line with what I mentioned a few moments ago, it is not necessary for an employee to characterize a complaint as a complaint. Supervisors should understand that if they know of an employee's concern, the company has a duty to act on it. Indeed, it is important for managers to know that by failing to act, they could be opening themselves up to personal liability, even if they are not the accused harasser. Similarly, supervisors need to be trained on how to deal with an employee who says they don't want the complaint to be repeated, either because they're afraid of retaliation or would like the complaint to be discreet. Because the supervisor stands in the employer's shoes, he or she cannot, under any circumstances, agree to absolute confidentiality. This brings us to our third tip, which is to investigate every single claim. This is not only the right thing for you to do, but the law requires a company to investigate when they're aware of a problem. No issue is too small or insignificant that it should not be investigated. Similarly, no employee should have his or her complaint ignored. This can be particularly challenging if the employee is a poor performer or if the employee seems to make frequent complaints about trivial issues. An employer has an obligation to take all complaints of sexual harassment seriously. This is also true of claims raised by resigning employees who may have mentioned something in an exit interview. Just because an employee is no longer part of the company does not relieve the company from its obligation to investigate. In its efforts to take complaints of sexual harassment seriously, the company must promptly and effectively take action. This means that the company should immediately look into what transpired, i.e., investigate. The first step is to take action to stop the harassment, which could mean separating the alleged harasser from the complaining employee. Next, the company must initiate its investigation. Most investigations do not require an employee to scorch the earth. It may be that there is no ambiguity or dispute about what transpired, in which case the investigation is not likely to be extensive. If the claim is against someone that is a peer or a supervisor to human resources, i.e. an executive, an independent investigator should be hired. Human resources should never investigate someone who could be considered to be at or above their level in the corporate structure. It is crucial that a company does not rush to judgment about the accused or the complainant. There can be conflicting reports of what transpired, which is why it is so important to conduct an impartial and objective investigation so that you can get to the bottom of every claim fairly. As the investigation unfolds, be sure to check back with the complainant to keep them informed about the status of his or her complaint. It is imperative for the person who came forward to know that the company is taking his or her concerns seriously, and of course, the company is obligated to do so. It is important to keep the investigation as confidential as possible, but under no circumstances should confidentiality be assured. In that same vein, the company should not require employees to sign confidentiality provisions or threaten discipline relating to confidentiality. Rather, the company should ask persons involved to keep the information discreet. Following the investigation, the company must decide what corrective actions should be taken, as it is important to hold harassers accountable. It is often debated about who in the company is in the best position to take that action, whether it should be HR or a manager. This decision should likely be made together and certainly will change depending on the circumstances of the situation and the position the harasser holds within the company. At the conclusion of every investigation, there should be a report of the outcome and a resolution of the issue. The report should contain the allegations, the procedure utilized in the investigation, all facts considered by the investigator, the conclusions that resulted from the investigation, and any action that will be taken as a result. If the outcome reflects that the company could not verify the allegations, the company should have an investigative letter that reflects just that. It is equally important under such circumstances to thank the employee for reporting his or her concerns and to encourage the employee to report any additional incidents of sexual harassment or retaliation. It is also a good idea to continually follow up with the employee to ensure that everything's okay. Lastly, there are often questions about where the investigation report should go. Reports should not go into the complainant's or accused personnel file. Only a record of any discipline that was taken as a result of an investigation should go in a personnel file. Otherwise, we recommend keeping any witness statements and other investigative documents in an independent and confidential investigative file or an HR complaint file. At this point, I'll pass it off to Mary, who will take you through the next few steps.
Thanks, Caitlin. Okay, so I would like to talk to you folks about ways that we can prevent or correct behavior before it rises to the level of actionable harassment. Our first tip on that line is to tell your management why and that they should not consider the staff to be their personal dating pool. I think it's important to be aware, and Judy mentioned this already, that there is a power imbalance in workplace interactions always, and abuse of this power imbalance often leads to claims of sexual harassment. For example, if a manager asks a subordinate on a date, she or he may not feel able to say no without suffering adverse consequences. Nupita Nyong'o, who is an actress, she was in 12 Years a Slave, wrote a recent New York Times article about her experiences with Harvey Weinstein and the difficulty she had interacting with him and ultimately saying no to his sexual advances. She wrote, "Before I got in the car to leave, I wanted to make sure that I had not awakened a beast that would go on to ruin my name and destroy my chances in the business even before I got there." For that reason, it's important to advise managers that even the best intentioned advances cannot be tolerated in the workplace. Another thing to remind managers is that there is personal liability under most state laws for harassment, and this personal liability does not come cheap. Often, juries can make the perpetrator pay in addition to the company. The average jury verdict in these cases is over $1.5 million, but it can go up to almost $200 million. A 2012 California case awarded a former physician's assistant $168 million when she brought claims alleging that a surgeon would greet her every morning by saying, "I'm horny," and then slapping her bottom. She alleged that when she reported this to the boss, he laughed. In addition to personal liability and large damages that could result, there's also a risk of workplace morale issues and productivity while a relationship is going on with a subordinate. For example, other employees could feel as though the employee in the relationship with the manager was being the favored employee and bring forth claims of favoritism. As we all know, many relationships do not end up working out forever, and so we have to consider what happens to life after breakups. If the supervisor and the subordinate were to break up, there would likely be lots of workplace disharmony and disruption. Rampant gossip could result, and as we've seen, civil lawsuits could also happen. In addition, there could be claims of retaliation that the company faces from employees who have been demoted, discharged, or suffered other adverse consequences as a result of, say, not engaging in sexual activities with the boss and then feeling like they suffered as a result of that, or for those employees who reported harassment or engaged in an investigation of harassment. And finally, there are intangible results that happen from claims of sexual harassment, not just the financial ones that we previously discussed, but intangible results such as damaged reputations of the manager and the company. And so, talking a little more specifically about removing the retaliation risk that I previously discussed, I wanted to spend a little time talking about retaliation in particular. And the reason we talk about retaliation so much is it's an easy claim to make. Retaliation is human nature. You can observe little kids playing in the playground at school, and you know that if somebody hits or somebody tattletales, the other kid's going to want to hit back. Also, employees, we believe, often suspect that their bosses retaliate, and there's a vague legal standard that goes along with retaliation. So for all these reasons, retaliation's a pretty easy claim to make. We also want to keep in mind that the company may have strict liability for both a manager's interactions as well as irregular employees' interactions. Company has strict liability for a supervisor's harassment, and they should also not ignore reports of harassment by any employee. For that reason, as I previously mentioned, employers we would advise should adopt a no dating or socializing policy, especially with management and subordinate employees. We don't think it's a good idea that management go on dates or spend time off duty with non-management. Management doesn't have the privilege or the luxury of taking off their manager hat at any moment, and what happens outside the workplace will come back into the workplace, and for that reason their conduct outside of work is just as important as their conduct at work. If romance develops, as it often does in workplaces, employers should beware of hostile work environment claims, not just quid pro quo claims. Hostile work environment claims often can develop again among colleagues, not just managers and supervisors. It's important that there's no reporting relationship that happens in the romantic relationship, and some employers have gone as far as to create love contracts. And what these are contracts between the two employees in a consensual relationship that set guidelines for behavior and prevent companies from liability should the relationship fall apart. Also, we would advise employers to communicate clear anti-retaliation policies. As Caitlin mentioned, employees shouldn't be punished for speaking up or participating in an investigation. And if a complaint should arise, it's important to check back with the witness or complainant for possible retaliation. As you all know, making a complaint is a protected activity, and as long as it's done in good faith from the perspective of the employee who is complaining, the employee does not have the right to be harassed and does not have to be right about being harassed either. And finally, warn the accused that retaliation is not allowed. And retaliation could take the form of tangible events, such as less or worse hours, demotion or discipline, and intangible as well, such as shunning the employee or excluding her from meetings. And we know this is tricky, because if we were to be accused ourselves, we wouldn't want to be around that person. That's why it's important to be aware and careful and not enter into these risky situations. And finally, we would advise companies to eliminate horseplay. We've found that body contact and crude jokes or gestures often result in sexual harassment claims. Again, it's important to consider the power imbalance here. When actions come from a manager, what was unproblematic among colleagues can become harassment. A recent study of waiters and waitresses in Austin, Texas, found that almost all of them engaged in a great deal of groping and fondling and frequently told sexual jokes and anecdotes. Most of them regarded this as unproblematic. As long as it was from colleagues, they regarded them as peers, it wasn't an issue. But when it came from a supervisor, they did not hesitate to call it harassment. And I also wanted to call to your attention a recent Ninth Circuit case in which a female correctional officer brought a claim of sexual harassment against her boss, who was the sheriff, as well as the county, and she alleged that over a 12-year period, her boss, the sheriff, hugged her multiple occasions and even kissed her on the cheek. The Ninth Circuit said this could give rise to a claim of sexual harassment and explicitly overturned the lower court's decision where they said that hugs and kisses on a cheek were just commonplace workplace behavior. And so be warned that hugging and kissing on the cheek is not as innocuous as it may seem. Just kidding around with no harm intended is not a viable defense. It's important to remember that harassment depends on how the conduct was received, not the intent. And the key term here is unwelcome. Sometimes behavior is welcome at the beginning, and then it becomes unwelcome when it escalates. And if something strikes you as off color or inappropriate, it doesn't belong at work. And it's important to remember, again, that everyone loses, even if the accusation doesn't have merit. Best practice going forward is to avoid questionable or unprofessional or offensive behavior. And also, if you're a manager or supervisor, don't wait for your employees to complain. Routinely check in with them, ask them about their job satisfaction and any concerns so we can address these before they rise to the level of actionable harassment. Okay, and now I'm turning it over to Chris.
Hello, everybody. Now we're moving on to tip number 7. I have started practicing law in 1981, which was the year that the EEOC definition of sex harassment was issued. All of us on this call have had hundreds of cases, defended them and handled them, and trained thousands of employees and managers and done scores of investigations. Our commitment is to help employers prevent this from happening and to create a respectful workplace. And tip number 7 is really, really important. You've got to train your managers and assistant managers before you promote them. Many of them were great in IT. They were a super salesperson. Maybe they were a superstar in the finance department, and that's why they got promoted, was for their technical skills. But many of them have no managerial skills at all, and maybe have never been through any kind of a respectful workplace or harassment training. So you've got to clue them in on their new role as a manager. So the first step is to let them be very cognizant of the fact that they are no longer one of the gang. And in fact, we recommend, if at all possible, assigning managers to a different location, a different department, provide them with another manager to help mentor them, and to make sure they maintain that separation between themselves as a manager and their former coworkers. Second, not only do you train them on harassment and what it is, but it's really about how to maintain a respectful workplace. It's got to be meaningful training. And in fact, when I'm asked to do sex harassment training by a client, I politely decline, and I will tell them, I will be happy to help you develop and lead a respectful workplace training of which sex harassment is a part. But if all you do is train on sex harassment in a vacuum, that will be a failed training program. But as part of the overall training to shift that culture, you've got to let managers understand what is harassment and how subtle it can be. And it's not just a request for date or sexual favor. They've got to understand the hostile work environment aspect of it. They need to know how to stop it in its tracks when you see it. For example, most managers are taught praise in public, criticize in private. When they see harassment happening, that's one exception to that rule. They've got to take a stand right then and say, that's inappropriate, please don't do that, please don't say that. You can call the person in later to have a stronger disciplinary discussion with them, but the manager has to visibly, in front of all the employees, take a stand. Otherwise, employees will think, why should I go complain to this manager? He or she saw it, they were right there, they laughed too, they didn't object to it, and I might as well not even bother. How to properly respond. Managers should not be, in most cases, tasked with trying to investigate and handle sex harassment claims. They have one job and one job only, call HR. A manager should never get into trouble for calling HR too much, but a manager can get themselves and the entire company into big trouble by not calling HR enough. Our next tip, number 8, continues to deal with some of the training issues. Don't just make sex harassment or even respectful workplace training a once a year or once every 2 year circumstance. Institutionalize the practice. Start a discussion. Have it respectful workplace discussed from a number of different aspects at a number of different types of meetings, manager meeting, all company meetings, assemblies, if you will, department meetings. Please, please consider doing in-person training. The click a box to answer some questions, read a book, watch a videotape, listen to an audio presentation just won't cut it. You've really got to stress how important a professional culture is to the entire company and why. The other issue is a number of articles recently have talked about why have the various steps that employers have taken for the last 30 to 60 years not worked. It's because a lot of that training is simply risk avoidance and not really a commitment to change the culture. As a recent New York Times article noted, this is not a knowledge problem. Sex harassment is a behavior problem. So just having the knowledge about what sex harassment is or other types of harassment or discrimination or how to maintain a respectful workplace isn't what it's about. It's about shifting behavior. And to have that paradigm shift, you've got to do meaningful, frequent training in a variety of settings. Have honest discussions. That's inappropriate. Please don't do that. Please don't say that. Have honest discussions about how somebody can and should come forward. Have honest discussions to train the observers so that they don't become enablers, that they can support the person, go with them to HR, that they can maybe help tell the person that the behavior they are engaging in is inappropriate. Teaching bystanders to intervene has been found to be a very effective tool to combating harassment. The goal is not to just deal with it when it happens, but the goal is to really shift the culture. Promoting more women has been the second most effective methodology for stopping sex harassment in the workplace. Same with having a diverse leadership group at the top has been shown to significantly reduce race harassment in the workplace. So you've got to really have a diverse employee base wherever possible and a diverse management base. It's critical to train all line employees and new hires before they start their first day of work. They need to learn how to speak up, report it, challenge it, expose it, help stop it. And again, retraining constantly is very critical. It doesn't matter if it's sex harassment legally or not, it's inappropriate and unprofessional behavior in the workplace. And that's what I try to train to, not just don't do it because it's against the law. Okay, that brings us to tip number 9. If you sell or serve alcohol, you have particularly enhanced problems. Or you have the sales meeting in Las Vegas. Number one, don't have any meetings for business purposes in Las Vegas. Sorry to any of you who are from that great city. But it seems to promote difficulties. I had a client decades ago who stopped having their sales meetings in Las Vegas, and their claims of harassment that always occurred, I was on call for those weekends, dropped to nil. Don't permit employees to drink at their work locations. If you have a party, have it someplace else besides the work location. Managers should skip drinks with staff or just drop in for one drink and then exit. And certainly, there should be no performance discussions in any kind of a social setting. I've had a lot of cases over the years where a socialized drinking situation, dinner situation was used as a subterfuge for let's discuss performance when it really was about establishing social pressure to have a personal relationship with that subordinate. Again, the goal is to preserve the organization's commitment to a professional and civil workplace so that everybody can work up to the best of their ability. And when alcohol is involved, for some reason, inhibitions leave everybody. Managers forget their role. Co-employees forget to respect their coworkers, and it turns into a harassment situation. Our next tip, and there's going to be a bonus tip. We call this the top 10, but we've got a bonus tip after this one. Give HR a seat at the table. In your organization, probably most of you participating in this webinar are in human resources. If you're not at the C-suite, you need to get at the C-suite or get into a company where they respect and value HR and give you a seat at the table. And also, HR doesn't have to handle everything by yourself. You can ask for help, perhaps a risk manager, perhaps another level of management has had some HR experience. Call your outside counsel. Use outside investigators. We know some excellent outside investigators that you can bring in, particularly, as Caitlin mentioned, when you've got to investigate somebody higher up in the company than HR. But HR needs to be in the C-suite leading the charge. And all of you on the phone who are in HR need to be able to show your top-level leadership that you are up to the job and that you can help them lead the charge to change the culture at the company and promote a respectful workplace where everybody can work up to their best of ability that is free from harassment and discrimination. Now, for our bonus tip today, take the couch out of the manager's office because no good and no good defense ever comes from the couch. And really, this is a euphemism for making sure that managers understand that they may no longer be able to be close buddies with their subordinates. No friending on Facebook. Be careful how you use social media. Be careful who you socialize with. Certainly don't brag about or make it well known if you are still having some kind of socializing relationship with a subordinate. The other subordinates will feel left out. They will fear retaliation by you if they complain about it, and they will feel like there's favoritism going on. And while that may not be harassment, you might be socializing with women as well as men, so it might not be sexual harassment. You might be socializing with persons of color rather than just white males. It can be perception, and we all know that perception becomes reality, and it is the manager's job to not only avoid discrimination, harassment, and disrespect in the workplace, their job and HR's job is to ensure that there's no perception that those things are happening. So managers have got to be the key to set the tone for a respectful workplace, and I hope these tips have helped you. Now I'm going to turn it back to Judy, who's going to give some closing comments and also answer some of your questions.
Yes, thank you very much to all of you. Let me just sort of tag on for just a brief moment to what Chris just said about taking the couch out of the manager's office. And again, that's just a sort of a simplification of the point, which I hope is well taken and well understood. But I would add to that, there are many off-site meetings and things of that nature where what we hear, sometimes shortly thereafter, sometimes long thereafter, is that the meeting adjourned to the bar, or the meeting then was continued in somebody's hotel room. There should never be business meetings in rooms with beds. I'll just say it that straightforwardly. Managers should be trained. Everybody should be trained. Coworkers should be trained. There should never be business meetings in rooms with beds. Not a good idea. No good can come from that defense. All right. We've got a variety of questions from folks, so thank you for posing them and more even coming in now. But let me start with a good question that kind of goes back to you, Caitlin, so maybe I'll ask you, please, to answer this question. What guidance do you have for employers who want to maybe right now, because of what is appearing in the papers and what is, you know, on top of mind for many of us, what guidance would you give to employers who want to maybe send a letter or communicate in some direct way with their employees about the company's commitment to what we're talking about here today and maybe even encouraging employees more so than they already have been to come forward? You got any tips for people who want to communicate out in that kind of way?
Sure. I mean, I think the ultimate root here is that it's important to talk about. No problems go away just because you ignore them, which is goes back to the underlying point, which is you need to investigate all claims that arise. But you shouldn't hesitate to reach out to your company and acknowledge what is happening right now. You know, it's been a few months, and this is still very much so in the forefront of the conversation. So, you know, go back to your policy, make sure it's up to snuff, redistribute your policy, and have someone in your company reinforce that this is what the company stands for, that sexual harassment will not be tolerated, and that everybody at the company is committed to making a respectful workplace for everyone.
Very good advice, and I would say, just for what it may be worth, that, you know, my law firm, the managing partner of our law firm, recently did exactly that to all of the employees at our firm. And he did it by email, and he did it in a thoughtful email, and one of the things he did before he sent the email was to send a draft of it to a few trusted people in the firm to say, did I get the tone right? Have I used the right words? What do you think? And he was given some input, because it is so terribly important that the tone be right, the message be clear and supportive, and all of the rest of it. So that's an idea, maybe get some input from some trusted people in the organization, but I think that's really good advice, Caitlin. Thank you for that. Another question that was asked is the historic claims from harassers. If the harassment somebody mentioned, and I've forgotten whether it was you, Caitlin, I think, if somebody mentions in an exit interview that there is a harasser in the workplace, it cannot be ignored, even though the complaining person or the person who is making the statement is leaving. But what about if the harasser is gone? If the harasser is no longer at the company, and it comes to light maybe later that there has been that harassment historically, does the company have an obligation then to reopen the issue and investigate potential harassment by someone who's no longer there? Anybody want to answer that question?
This is Chris. I can jump in on that. Absolutely, the answer is yes. You want to know whether anybody has been harassed, whether it's by a former employee or not. And frequently when we do these investigations or work with HR and they do them or use an outside investigator, we'll find that more than one person was involved in the harassment, or there are more people who have suffered harassment. And so it's very critical. Remember, the employer has an affirmative obligation to maintain a workplace free from harassment and discrimination. The law doesn't say the employer can let whatever they want to go on until someone complains. That is not the law. So even if it's an employee who has left that's complaining, or the person about whom the complaint is made has left, the company absolutely still has an obligation to look into it.
Great. And Chris, while you've got the floor, maybe you can answer another question that has come in. Could you please elaborate on what subjects should be addressed in a respectful work environment training in addition to sexual harassment?
Absolutely. I think the key is to make sure that, I mean, obviously within your respectful workplace policy or your non-discrimination policy, there should be a section dealing with sex harassment, of course. But sex harassment is so fraught with this he said, she said, and quote-unquote frivolous claims, and it's a gray area that it's very hard to train to. But employees and managers get it better, I think, when it's taught in the context of it is discrimination. There is no separate law on sex harassment. It is a form of discrimination. And people get that I would never intentionally discriminate against somebody. So teaching it in that context is really important. What is the history? How was it developed? But then moving from the legal issues to societal issues. How do we make this culture change? How do we treat each other with more respect? Everybody in the workplace. How do we recreate a respectful workplace? So your policy should start out with a respectful workplace policy, funnel into discrimination, then into harassment, and the training should follow those same steps. We do trainings, for example, where I work with a client to develop fact scenarios that have really happened or that could happen in their workplace, and have the participants get together in small groups and discuss how would they handle that situation, and so that they then have some personal responsibility. They're not just listening to a talking head or online test or listening to a speaker either pre-recorded or even a speaker live. It's got to be an interactive session so you can start having that honest discussion. So I hope those points help you.
And a couple of very specific questions that have come in, and I'll just answer them myself for the first one anyway. Is there a right to counsel? Does an employee have a right to counsel during an internal investigation of a harassment situation? And the answer is no. There is no right to counsel. The law doesn't provide for that. There's no legal right to counsel, so the answer is no. I will say that there are times when the investigator and the company that's responsible for the investigation may decide that they want to allow it. That would be an individual situation, and it's beyond the scope of this program, really, to talk about what exactly may motivate a company to say, okay, yes, you may have your attorney present. Those situations are rare, but they do exist. In the main, employees should not have an attorney present during an internal company investigation, and they certainly do not have a legal right to have an attorney present. So that's the answer to that. Another question, and maybe I'll put this out for whoever wants to answer it. Why do we recommend that employee complaints of this nature not be included in their personnel files? What's the reason for not including the complaints in the personnel file? Anybody?
Well, this is Chris again. go ahead. Was that Mary? Somebody else want to jump in? Go right ahead.
Sorry, I'll just start off. This is Caitlin. I'll just jump in for one or two points, and I'm sure you can elaborate on them. One reason is that more than a few people can have access to personnel-related documents for a various number of reasons, and investigations like this should be kept as confidential as possible. So that's one reason to have those documents be held in a separate location, because for both the accused and the complaining person, it's best to have those kinds of issues handled as discreetly as can be.
This is Chris. I was just going to add that it really can have a chilling effect if the person making the complaint knows that his or her complaint is going to end up in their personnel file. That's completely backwards. And also, it's not good to have the entire investigation in the accused's file either, because you may want to protect it under the attorney-client privilege or as a confidential personnel record. What is critical, though, is that any resolution letter go in the accused's file. Even if it's a he said, she said, and you couldn't determine through independent evidence what actually happened, you want to reinforce force with both parties. Please come forward if anything like this happens again. It's definitely against our policy. And remind the accused that if you did engage in behavior like this or do in the future, that you would face consequences. It's against our policy. Where there's smoke, there's fire. So if somebody's had two or three of these in the past, you've got to be able to know that, because the fourth one that comes up, somehow it might end up lending more credence to those first three complaints, or the first two complaints if you're the second or third one. So I think it's important to keep some kind of record that's accessible by accused name about the circumstance that they were accused, but not necessarily in the personnel file.
All right. Another question that has come in from, you know, can corrective action or discipline that comes out of the out of the complaint, so discipline against the harasser, if it is concluded that that is appropriate, can that be shared with the complainant? And I'll answer that question. The answer is yes. And it's a part of a broader question, and this is another question that in conclusion, a point that in conclusion I was planning to make, and I will make it right now. And that is the whole issue of confidentiality. We haven't talked about that yet today, but it is one of the issues that is in the headlines, and that is, some would say, and I think probably accurately so, part of the problem, part of the responsibility for where we are today, can be said to be because of confidential complaints, or rather confidential settlements, confidential resolution of complaints that allows the harassment to go on because the resolution, the behavior is kept in some secret way. So part of what we are all having to ask now as we are seriously looking at how the heck can we have harassment be gone, be not anymore in the workplace to the extent to which that's humanly possible to achieve. Part of the answer has got to be looking carefully at confidentiality. Please do not hear me to say that confidentiality should be thrown out the window and there should no longer be confidential settlements. I am not saying that. I would not say that. But I do say that I think we need to revisit and think on an individualized basis with each situation, each settlement, each problem that we are trying to solve, where should confidentiality fit into this particular situation? And I believe, and I know from very recent experience, that there are times when it may be the best thing to say, we're not going to keep this confidential. We have no obligation to do it, so we choose not to do it. So I do think that if we are trying to get the message out there, and this goes back to what Caitlin said at the very, very beginning about setting the tone, we are serious about not tolerating harassment, that when there is harassment, when it has occurred, that a very important and very meaningful, powerful way of getting the message out that we really won't tolerate it may be to communicate throughout the organization, or at least to the key people who were involved in the investigation, certainly accusing the certainly including the complaining party, may be to explain what happened as a result of the behavior that was engaged in. And I certainly recognize that we are balancing here the privacy rights of employees, including harassing employees who don't entirely give up their privacy rights, versus the right to ensure a harassment-free workplace. So it's a balancing question. The answer to the person's question is certainly you have to let the complaining person know that something significant happened, exactly what is told about, you know, the person was demoted, or the person lost their bonus, or the person, you know, got a final written warning in their file. You know, how much detail you go into will depend on a whole lot of considerations. But part of the remedy of harassment may sometimes be having the harasser have to give up his right to privacy if he's going to remain employed in the discipline that was perpetrated. So that's a long-winded answer to your question, but it's a very good question that brings up all kinds of considerations about what is the role of confidentiality when there has been an incident of harassment and we're trying to settle it. So this goes right into somebody asked what privacy rights do harassers have. Well, they don't have privacy right in the harassment, that's for sure. But, you know, do they have a privacy right in their personnel records? Yes, they do. But again, privacy is always a balancing consideration. I mean, nobody has an absolute right to privacy. If there's a subpoena, it has to be turned over, etc. So part of the penalty, if you will, for engaging in harassment may be a kind of sacrificing of the right to privacy. So it's a complicated question and very much fact-specific, fact-driven. So, but, you know, the question raises, and a number of questions have come in, and I think, you know, to sort of put this out there now in the big picture way, we haven't talked much about the rights of harassers, in part because, you know, I would submit that harassers, it's like, what's the right of an embezzler? Well, if somebody embezzles from you, they certainly don't have the right to protect the embezzlement, that's for sure. Same with harassment. But I realize I'm oversimplifying. What about the rights of an employee who has been accused of harassment, who may have done something inappropriate but not horrible, not off the chart, really bad? You know, what are the rights of that person? And I'll kick it off and then invite my colleagues to add to what I would say. They certainly have a right to due process, and this goes back to the investigation. Every claim needs to be investigated. Not every claim has merit. Not every claim should result in the harasser being fired, for heaven's sake. We all know that. There are sometimes malicious claims that are brought, claims that have absolutely no bearing in fact, but are brought for a malicious purpose. There are claims that are bordering on frivolous. Yeah, something happened, but good heavens, it wasn't all that bad. So none of us is saying, no one has said that just because a claim is brought, therefore the accused is, you know, adjudged to be guilty in the way that we are now talking about. And we have to acknowledge that when there are 6 or 7 or 8 people who bring a similar claim, well, the chances of its having happened certainly goes up, just as a matter of logic, but it still doesn't mean that there doesn't have to be a careful investigation so as to afford, if you will, due process to to the rights of the accused, and that the truth, to the extent to which human beings are capable of, you know, figuring that out, that the truth is identified, and then action that's appropriate to the situation is taken. What do you do, though, Chris and others, what do you do if it really does boil down in the end to the classic he said, she said, there are no witnesses, there's no maybe, you know, external fact that would support one over the other, no circumstantial evidence that would tend to bolster one person's claim over the other. What is the responsibility of the employer or the employer's investigator in the situation where it boils down to he said, she said?
Judy, that's the million-dollar question. Couple of points on this issue. First, I've been doing this for over 30 years, 35 years actually, and I can't say that I've ever seen a totally frivolous complaint. Something always happened in the workplace. Something was said or done, and as Judy said, maybe it was something extremely minor, and it's being taken out of context, exaggerated, for maybe even a malicious purpose. But I will tell you, something always happened. And this is why companies have to have zero tolerance. You don't worry about, did this investigation rise to the level of illegal sexual harassment? It's a violation of your professionalism policy in the workplace, for example. So in the classic situation, and this is, I would say, a good grouping of harassment cases, and not just sex harassment, but race harassment, age harassment, comments made out of the earshot of anyone else and no circumstantial evidence to support. You still have to respect the person who felt like something happened and thank them for coming forward, encourage them to come forward if they have any retaliation or experience other complaints, and remind the person accused that while we did not find corroborating evidence, that does not mean it didn't happen. Okay, so it's there's a difference in your finding of this did not happen versus we had no independent corroborating evidence. And remind the person of what your policy is. Maybe send everybody back through training or train the department again. But you can't just do nothing and throw up your hands and say, well, I can't tell what happened, so I'm going to do nothing. So that's the important point I hope everybody takes away from our presentation today.
Good. Another question. We have just a couple of minutes remaining, but there are some excellent questions, and I can tell already we're not going to have a chance to get to all of them. So please understand we know who you are, and we will try to answer your questions separately if we're not able to get to them in the group today. But a question tagging along to what we just said a minute ago, if a past employee asks for a copy of their personnel file, do they have a right to the documentation of the investigation, assuming it's not in their personnel file? And the answer is they do not. Not just with a request, at least under California law, where I practice in San Francisco in California, employees have a right to a copy of their personnel file, and former employees have a right to a copy of their personnel file, and what the personnel file is defined to be is kind of specific in the law, but it certainly does not include an investigation file. So that is an additional reason, perhaps, not to keep it in the personnel file, as it's not really a personnel record of the sort that an employee has a right to have or a former employee has a right to have. This is not to say that they won't get the file if there is a lawsuit or a claim brought, that they have the right then to subpoena all the records that are pertinent to their claim. Then, of course, they will have a right to that, which addresses another question that was asked, you know, when an investigation is conducted, should copies of the raw investigation notes be kept or should they be destroyed once the investigation report is filed? I don't think there's any black and white answer on that. I think it depends on the investigator's standard practice, whatever the standard practice is. You certainly don't want to deviate from it in a particular case. If the interview notes are carefully done, there may be good reason to keep them. If, on the other hand, they're just kind of sloppy notes that someone has taken and then they become memorialized in a more formal document, the sloppy notes may perhaps be thrown away. So I think it depends. But once a claim is brought, of course, nothing can be thrown away. Not the notes, not the rough draft of the notes, not the text messages about the notes. None of that can be thrown away. So it is important to have a standard practice, to make a decision up front as to how you're going to do it, and then stick with that practice when in every case that comes before you. So I think we're down to 1 minute left. Is there some wrap-up that somebody needs to do, or shall I just declare our time up at this point? And thank you all for attending. Thank you for your very, very fine questions, as I say, many of which we have not been able to address in the time that we had, but we know who you are, so we will do our best to answer your questions in the next day or two.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the speak to all our speakers. A link to an online evaluation is now displayed on your screen. Please take a few moments to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. This concludes today's webinar, and thank you for attending.